While people are coming in, there is someone probably in this group who owns a white Lexus Utah X18 4AZ parked in an illegal stall on the south end of the first row. If you want to encounter your car at the end of the conference, you better go move it. Thanks. Okay, well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to the third day of this annual review of law and religion. It's my pleasure as director of the center, the International Center for Law and Religion Studies, to welcome you again, yet again today. As a final set of people are coming in, one thing I might remind you, I think many of you here are probably already receiving our headlines from the center. This is a service that reviews what is literally an outpouring of things that I suppose people can find if they do Google feeds and others, but we have people who wade through this and on an almost daily basis send out emails that are broken down by developments in the US, developments in Europe, and developments internationally more generally. This is in some ways a little bit overwhelming. I think many of us look at it quickly, glance at headlines, and see things that are important. But if you want to stay abreast of things, that's something that I alert you to. And if you go to the center website, www.iclrs.org, and you're a little bit enterprising, you will easily find out how to sign up for that. And if you have any, and if you're like me and are not always enterprising or not always fully computer literate, talk to one of our staff and we can get you signed up for that. It's something I use all the time, not only for sort of day-to-day currency, but if I'm looking at something for a particular country or other things, you can go back and search. Okay, with that, we'd like to start our session this morning. We've asked Elder Robert Orton, an Emeritus General Authority of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and a strong supporter of our center, and he and his wife have just been called to go serve church missions as government relations representatives for the church in Geneva, Switzerland. So, Elder Orton.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. We give thanks to thee for the opportunity to be here and to have learned and to have the opportunity to continue to learn about law and religious freedom. We're particularly grateful this morning to have Governor Herbert here. And we pray for him that he will be able to say and do that which will be beneficial to those in attendance. We're so grateful for the organizers of this review. They do so well, and we're grateful for those who have traveled from afar and those who have come from local places. We pray that thy spirit be with us here this morning, that our minds might be open and receptive to the truths which will be taught here. We pray that thy will, not ours, be done. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.
So at the beginning of the session this morning, it's our privilege to have Dean James Rasband with us, Dean of the J. Reuben Clark Law School. Any of you who have had the experience of running academic programs know how significant it is to have strong backing from your university administration. We are so thankful for Jim and all he does to help us and to further our work. So, Jim.
I am delighted to just take a second and say hello, and thank you all for participating in this conference. I know that we're all eager to hear from Governor Herbert, and it's an honor to have him here today. But I wanted to take just a second to greet you. I haven't been here the last couple of days, but I have heard reports from both some of our students who are attending and many of the attorneys who are here that it's just been fabulous, that the presentations have been off the charts in terms of their depth and insight. And so I thank those who've presented for making this such a successful conference, and I'm sure today will be more of the same. As you can imagine, this issue of religious liberty is a pretty important one for us at the law school. And religious liberty is what allows us to engage in this project that we're engaged in, which is to build a great LDS law school. I mean, it's the only LDS law school in the country. We want it to be a great one. And we have to have religious liberty to do that. I mean, of course, across a number of dimensions where we spend a lot of our time, we look a lot like other law schools, and we're trying to build in all the ways you'd expect other law schools to build. And our students are in the top 25 in the entire country. We have an extraordinary faculty. But, you know, just to be like every other great law school in the country is not enough. And we have to be more than that. And frankly, the work of the International Center for Law and Religion Studies at the law school is a part of that effort. And historically, I mean, since their founding, they've spent most of their time on international religious liberty issues, and I've been really eager for them to do more and more in the domestic space, and this particular conference is a part of that effort, and it's fun to see it evolving in such a short time, to see the kind of group that they've assembled here of those of you who want to learn and who are concerned about these issues and want to help all of us think about this really hard question of how to integrate religious liberty with non-discrimination principles, and to try to work together in a spirit of optimism and compromise. I don't want to go on any further. Senator Adams will have the opportunity to introduce Governor Herbert. It is really an honor for the law school and for the university to have him here today to participate. He has really been a leader nationally in this effort to protect religious liberty while discouraging discrimination and to look for ways to accommodate different values and different views. And I think he's pointed the way forward for liberty to flourish in some pretty important ways. So I'm so grateful to have him here today. I'll turn the time over now to Senator Adams, who likewise has been a leader on this issue in Utah, to introduce the governor. And again, thank you for being here, and I look forward to the panel.
I'm really excited to be here to be able to introduce the governor of this great state of Utah, Governor Gary Herbert. I think many of you know that before the governor started his political career, he was involved in the real estate industry. And because of that, he understands the principles of self-reliance and of independence and protecting property rights and individual rights, and I think that's one of the reasons he's been such a great governor, great supporter. But after he started his political career, I think he was county commissioner here in Utah County, and then he was lieutenant governor, and I knew him a little bit more as lieutenant governor as I saw him travel the state. I know he wore out a couple of vehicles, or at least and a lot of shoes and maybe some boots, but I don't think anybody has traveled from the four corners of the state of Utah or understands both geographic and economic and social impacts of the state more than Governor Herbert, as he served as lieutenant governor. Now, he's been the governor of the state for a few years, took over in very difficult economic times, some of the worst economic times we've seen as a nation. As we looked at what was happening around Utah has come out of that. We've led the nations. We've been recognized over and over again as one of the strongest states economically and, I believe, socially and morally in the nation. Many states are looking to us. I believe it's because of great leadership. The governor's been absolutely phenomenal as a leader, not only in Utah, but respected around the nation. In fact, I think he's set to be, at the end of this month, a chairman of the National Governors Association. So these issues and other issues like it, he'll have the opportunity not only to help and use the principles that are so significant that we've been able to implement in Utah to be able to spread those throughout the nation. So again, it's great to have you here. Appreciate you being here. With that, I'd welcome you here, Governor. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Stuart, and I am honored to be here, back in my alma mater here at BYU, and see the great things that are taking place here in this campus, again, as a good example to other universities and in many ways. And so for those who are here visiting from out of the state, we certainly welcome you here to Utah and on the campus of BYU, and I'm hopeful that you're enjoying your stay here and find it not only enjoyable but productive. With that, let me just say I appreciate the prayer that was given, an exercise of religious freedom. And I am a believer in the efficacy of prayer. And I remember when I was first the governor and after my inauguration, it was not uncommon for people to say something that was not common before. And that was, we're praying for you. And it was a nice thing. And I know my wife and I, the First Lady Jeanette, we're very appreciative of people saying we're praying in your behalf. And again, as a believer in the efficacy of prayer, I appreciate that I need all the help I can get, and I do look beyond myself for guidance and direction. But I had one day, one of my staff members, I guess concerned I may be getting a little less humble than I should have been because of that, said, I want you to read what was sent here. And it was a statement by some individual that has said that if Gary Herbert's going to be the governor of the state of Utah, then God help us. And so I've assumed and believe that I've brought people together in prayer here in the state of Utah, which is probably a good thing. Also, I've thought about this. I know we have a number of attorneys here with us, and this is kind of a legal issue. And I recognize our director and our dean here, Dean Rasbin and Director Durham, and for their efforts in organizing this and putting this together. And I know some continuing education is a part of this. It's attorneys are an interesting lot, you know, politicians, in fact, are very similar in many ways. And I've heard the story that maybe you've heard of about a group of people getting together trying to determine who is the most important profession. And the medical profession stepped right up and said, well, at the beginning of the world, we had Adam and Eve. And, of course, we had birth and begatting and multiplying and replenishing the earth. And so medicine, clearly the most important because it was there in the beginning. And the engineers and the scientists said, well, wait. Before Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, there was a lot of chaos in the universe, and it had to be organized. And so engineering and science was, in fact, the first and therefore the greatest profession in the history. And, of course, the politicians and the lawyers winked at each other and then said in unison, where do you think all that chaos came from in the first place? I think as we look at religious freedom and what's taken place here recently at the Supreme Court decision and other aspects, there seems to be in people's minds a lot of chaos. The order of things has been changed, and has been changed in somewhat of an abrupt manner. Normally we think in terms of change that occurs through the legislative process. That's how it's kind of been designed to do. Occasionally, though, we have the courts that step in and have an abruptness to it that sometimes is a little unsettling. That's a concern for me as a governor of the state of Utah. It's a concern, I know, for our legislators who think that's the responsibility of us as we reflect the views of the people. and the legislative process sometimes gets circumvented, which causes us to have a little bit of a pause and say, wait a minute, is this really where we want to be? Is this the right process we should follow in order to get and reflect the will of the people and the principles of that the people espouse? I want to, in fact, give tribute to our great legislature and others that were involved in this process of a coming together, which is pretty unique, certainly across the country today. Senator Adams, and he would be the first to say it was a team effort, but in every team there's a leader, there's a quarterback on the football team, or somebody that's coaching the basketball team to kind of lead out and get things to happen. And Senator Adams has done great work in what we call kind of the Utah Compromise in trying to balance anti-discrimination for the LGBT community, as well as making sure we preserve and protect anti-discrimination against the religious practice of the population. Not an easy thing to do, and again, I know that even in the results we've had, which I think are being quite envious by other states. In fact, I was just in Nevada with 10 governors, and I had a number of them that came to me and said, tell us how you did this in Utah, because we're not having that kind of success in our state. We still have a lot of chaos and animus and angry folks on all sides of the issue. Tell us how you did it in Utah. And so we've been greeted with some significant praise and accolades, and I do believe well-deserved. I've said before that the country needs a good role model. It needs a good example. Heaven knows there are plenty of bad examples out there. I'm pleased as the governor of Utah that we are becoming the good example in this country in many ways. This is just one of them. But it is greeted with accolades and somewhat a large dose of surprise. I'll just read you a headline from the Washington Post, dated March 12th of 2015, this year. Utah. Yes, Utah passes landmark LGBT rights. That was the headline with some kind of puzzlement. And, you know, some have heralded it as a miracle that it happened. The common question has always been, why? Why Utah? We get that question a lot. Stuart mentioned that we're number one. We are absolutely number one in the nation when it comes to economic development today over the last 4 months. We have the fastest growing job creation economy in America today, and people ask why. How did that happen? So this is not an unusual thing. But my answer is, and why not? Why not us? We have the ability. We certainly have the talent. We have good people, good principles and values. And so why not us to find the way to, as I've said metaphorically, thread the needle, which balances rights for all people and gets us to the point where we can, in fact, work together and associate together and know that we are free, that we have liberty and freedom as envisioned in our Constitution. I would say this too, that probably nowhere in this country is the nexus between religious freedom and anti-discrimination more pronounced, more understood than in Utah. It's our history. And again, I'm proud of Utah's history. I'm a seventh generation Utahan. I have great reverence for my ancestors. I had ancestors that came across on the Mayflower. I'm a first cousin to Benjamin Franklin, 11 generations removed. My ancestors came across in the first year with Brigham Young to this valley, the Salt Lake Valley, and said, this is the right place, drive on. I understand the challenges that my ancestors went through to try to find a place where they could worship and be free to worship as they pleased. What was given under the Constitution and our First Amendment, but was not being upheld by the law. So why not Utah? We understand it probably as well as anybody else, this challenge of making sure we have religious freedom. and that we have a law that in fact upholds the ability to worship as we choose. How, where, and what they may is, I think, the article of faith that the LDS faithful quote. And I know that our ancestors fled persecution. I mean, loss of housing and property, and stock, life. So why not Utah? And I would say, too, although it is, I think, somewhat unique, the Utah experience and those settlers of 1847, it's not totally unique to the American experience. A large reason why my ancestors came across on the Mayflower and others that followed those early pilgrims was to find a place where they could, in fact, worship as they understood it, free from a state-dominated, mandated religion. So the right of freedom of association to worship is an American value. And so we have a deep understanding, and I think every student of history understands that. But I would just caution again, as we look at history, we haven't always gotten it perfect. We have good intentions, I think, and as we understand issues better, sometimes we've found that we are maybe not right dead center like we had hoped we would be. We have not always had religious freedom as we would understand it today in this country. Let me just give you a few examples to kind of refresh your memories of some that have happened in the past. Only Christians were allowed to hold public office in Massachusetts. Non-Christians not allowed in the early days of our country. In 1777, New York's state constitution banned Catholics from holding office. And in fact, if they were allowed to, they had to renounce papal authority in order to be able to be qualified to hold office. Maryland granted full civil rights to Catholics, but not to Jews. So they had a discrimination there that was unfortunate. Delaware required its citizens to swear an oath reaffirming their belief in the Holy Trinity. So you had to believe in my concept or our concept based on the people's view of God. Several states, including Massachusetts and South Carolina, had, in fact, state-supported churches. We got away from the Church of England, but then we came here and created our own state-sponsored religion here in some of the states in the early founding of our country. So despite the assertion we have in the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal and have certain unalienable rights, you know, we have certainly trampled on those unalienable rights in our history. And as we've tried to find the better way to form the more perfect union as part of our constitutional goals as outlined in our Constitution and certainly in our Declaration of Independence. We do believe in the pursuit of happiness, not in the guarantee, but in the ability for people to pursue happiness free from persecution as long as we abide by the laws of civilized society and have equal opportunity to pursue their dreams and aspirations and be a part of the common good. Discrimination against race, gender, immigrants, Native Americans, people of faith, and other groups has often been too much a commonplace in our country's history. But thankfully, as we recognize those mistakes that we've made, we've come together as people through elected leadership, our politicians, our elected officials, our Congress, our legislators, our local community leaders, our religious leaders working together and found ways that we can in fact provide a positive result to resolve these inequities which have taken place. And the result is that our societal and legal landscapes have been improved and we respect each other more as we understand how important it is to have respect for people, even though they might have a different point of view than we do. And because of that, we've changed. We've evolved, I think, in many ways, to a better place than we've had since in the past 200 years of our country to a better place today. Not in every instance. I think there's concerns out there with the moral degradation that's taking place and others. And I would just caution us all as we talk in terms of religious freedom, which is kind of brought to bear because of the same-sex marriage issue, which is certainly an important issue. But we're talking about, 5% of the population. And we ought to be concerned if there's moral degradation, and I believe that there are reasons to be concerned. The 95% of the rest of society has to bear some of the burden of that challenge. When we talk about every child deserves a mother and a father and a home, I hear that all the time, and I think that probably is the ideal. We see, though, in our inner cities and parts of the country where illegitimacy is at the 75% rate. This is not the LGBT gay community. These are heterosexuals that are, in fact, not having fathers and or mothers, single parenthood, which is, in fact, depriving young people of probably good nurturing and be able to be the best they can be in a good, stable environment. We ought not to forget that the 95% out there have got some issues that ought to be addressed, and our religious leaders need to, in fact, step it up and see what we can do to help in that regard. Let me just talk a little bit. I know some of you have heard this story before, and I hope I'm not too redundant here, but the passage of Utah Senate Bill 296 is, in fact, a shining example of the ability of us with a very difficult and complex and emotional issue in the state of Utah to come together. We shouldn't be surprised that this is kind of the Utah way. We do come together in ways that are quite remarkable. We were earlier this year recognized by the United States Chamber of Commerce as the number one enterprising state in America. It has to do with our economy and the fact that we are healthy. We've come out of the recession better than anybody in America. And we ranked in their top 10 in the top 10 in all their ranking categories, and the only state so to do. In fact, it was the second year in a row we're the only state to be ranked in all their categories in the top 10. So hence the number one ranking for the most enterprising state in America. The important part of the story, though, was in their analysis of why Utah. They talked in terms of the spirit of collaboration and cooperation in Utah was at a more positive degree than any state they found in America. Meaning we do work together. We are willing to sit down and talk, not past each other, but with each other and see if we cannot, in fact, resolve differences with mutual respect and a sincere desire to, in fact, protect agency and protect rights of individuals and protect against discrimination in any form. Whether you need a law for it or not, it certainly is a culture of Utah to protect against discrimination. So the signing of Senate Bill 296 was a great day for Utah. Certainly I'm honored to be a part of that effort as the governor. But there are two principal reasons, I think, about that. For what it did, for what it accomplished, again, as an example to the country. I think that's important. As we have governors that have talked to me about how did you do it, again, they're trying to copy and emulate the process we had here in the state of Utah. We've seen some really negative impacts where people have done it a different way, and the fallout and the ramifications in a negative way of failed attempts. So I appreciate what we've been able to accomplish here in Utah. And secondly, I believe it represents the best qualities of our society in Utah. The willingness to come together and tackle difficult issues, and I call this a Utah solution to what we perceive to be a state issue, a Utah challenge, and we came up with a good solution here and worked together to resolve a difficult and emotional issue. Let me just mention the concept of the bill was simple, and really the concept to balance protections for religious beliefs and acts with anti-discrimination with the LGBT community and their individuals when it came to employment and housing. This started a number of years ago in Utah. This is not just something that happened here in Utah this year. We think about it because of same-sex marriage, but this started about 4 years ago. And again, the Board of Trustees of the Brigham Young University, on whose campus we're here today, contacted me and others and said we will support a city ordinance on anti-discrimination for LGBT individuals and families. And they made their statement at a Salt Lake City Council meeting for the first time. And that, in fact, started a movement of anti-discrimination ordinances that went to about 20 different cities and then spawned a desire to have a statewide anti-discrimination. So this has been for us, at least on the anti-discrimination aspect of this, in the works for a number of years. Kind of blossomed a little bit this year and a little more profound way, obviously, because of same-sex marriage. But it's been a journey that was undertaken in Utah, led by some of our religious leaders, not just LDS, but certainly LDS has been a prime mover in the idea of let's have anti-discrimination ordinances in place to protect the minority position in the state of Utah when it comes to gay rights. So anyway, it's a simple concept, but it's only simple until you sit down and start talking about the details of how it's going to work and what the ramifications of this ordinance is going to be to society who has a history that's a little bit different than that. And how does it fit? You know, we have hundreds of references in our state statutes and codes to marriage. And it's defined as man and woman. We as a state, ironically so, could not become a state until we defined in our Constitution that it was one man and one woman because of plural marriage. So it certainly is relevant to Utah's history and certainly relevant to our past. And the question is, and now what does it mean with this new change with the decree of the courts, et cetera. As we're trying to put together anti-discrimination that does not, in fact, step on religious rights and liberties. So without making any kind of a religious comment here, the devil is in the details. those details really probably we don't know. I don't know that we'll know the ramifications of all we've done here for a number of years, maybe a generation. What this is going to impact us and how. Some of the questions, for example, what does it mean to protect a religious belief? I don't know how many of you remember Brandon Eich. Brandon Eich was the CEO of Mozilla, a high-tech firm. And in 2014, he was fired as the CEO of that tech company. Why? Because 6 years prior, he had donated $1,000 to California's Proposition 8. And yet because of that, you know, by all accounts, he was a wonderful employer and ran the company very well, was very kind and considerate to all people, including the gay community. And yet because he donated $1,000 to Proposition 8, which was designed to define marriage as between a man and a woman, he was fired from his position and very significantly attacked by the gay community because of that effort. Well, what does it mean to protect a religious belief? What does it mean to protect a transgender individual from discrimination in his or her employment? Transgender is a part of the gay community that really is a little more difficult for some people, particularly depending on appearance and what happens in the business environment. So how do you protect the transgender individual from discrimination? Should a large corporation be treated the same as a small family-run business? You know, we've seen what's taken place with company up in Oregon that were providing cupcakes and pastries and things and cakes to weddings, and yet because of their religious belief, they did not want to decorate a cake that espoused a point of view that was different than their own religious beliefs and were found in violation of Oregon's law and just fined, and the fine was upheld here just in the last week, $135,000. They're out of business now. And that's a debate of what happens in the public square. When you open yourself up to business, what can you act, what can you do? The only similar case like that we can find is one that happened in New Mexico, where an individual refused to, in fact, set up a floral arrangement at a gay wedding. They were fined about $6,500. So the proportionality, you know, is that fair or is that just a piling on? Some of the accusations were made were, you know, because of this lack of a refusal to provide cakes to the wedding was shame and discomfort and embarrassment by the gay couple, and the profound national attention it brought, and they had, and also was had a loss of appetite and weight gain. They had both things going there. So, but again, $135,000 is not insignificant, and they're out of business now. And so what about their rights? Where does that religious right in the public square, my right to practice and act, end with what I have to do when I, in society, and the obligation to, in fact, not discriminate based on the law? Those challenges are significant. As I've mentioned, we probably don't know all the questions, let alone all the answers to these issues that we're going to have to work through together. I appreciate Senator Adams taking on that responsibility and trying to thread the needle. Now, I don't know if it's because of great leadership on his part or he just drew the short straw, but he's done a great job in helping bring Utah together. So anyway, we thank all for that effort. Let me just kind of finish up here with a point that we'll have some question and answer here. But our compromise, you know, does not mean that everybody got everything. As I met with religious leaders, and it was not just the LDS Church, but other faith-based organizations out there too that are concerned about anti-discrimination, the realization was that, you know, we're not going to be able to please everybody. Sometimes in politics, it's a matter of, can you please the 80% and have the extremes on both sides? You know, we'll never be satisfied. And that's probably okay, but and have ongoing discussion and debate as part of the court, conversation we probably need to have and have had certainly historically. But as we came together, one of the things that became obvious to me, and I think to the legislature, is we could not have competing bills. That sets us up for I win and you lose. And that's the fear. Whether that's the reality or not, the perception becomes the reality. And so having competing bills was not a good process. And Senator Adams and our legislators recognized that we needed to bring those competing ideas together in one bill so they could work together and actually find. It compelled compromise. It compelled us to come together. I don't think it hurt that I promised a veto if I had one bill and not the other bill, that they couldn't come to me separately. And I think that was one of our secrets, was that we actually compelled everybody to come together and work like we're trying to find the proverbial win-win for both sides. Not just to gain political points, not to appease a special interest group out there or not, but to see if we could literally get something positively done. And not everybody got what they wanted. Certainly nobody got everything they wanted. But both sides, I believe, felt that they should have more, but felt good about where we were able to arrive at our conclusion, with our conclusions. And certainly congratulations are in order for all those who were a part of it. They rejected the all or nothing approach, which too often we find taking place in other states today. Now, let me just sum up here and mention what I think is important as part of this discussion too. And that is this, in light of the current political climate and the recent Supreme Court decision regarding same-sex marriage, I don't think we can talk about religious liberties without referencing the change that this decision is going to have and is having on the landscape for religious protections. To not think that somehow those are associated together and tied together is to, you know, have our head in the sand, because certainly the ramifications of the Supreme Court are going to be felt by all states, including Utah, and certainly has an impact on current existing statutes and how we, in fact, will address these issues going forward. The experience in Utah that I've just talked about, how we've come together, is really that of different people coming together with a sincere desire, a willingness to say, look, let's work together. Sometimes people aren't willing to do that. I mean, I see it in politics all the time. And the fact that we're able to work together and find a place where people felt like you should be able to live your life without discrimination as a member of the gay community, and likewise, you and the religious community should be able to practice your religion without discrimination also. They're both discrimination. And whether we call it religious liberties or not, unfortunately, in my view, the process that we've had, I kind of alluded to, the legislative process where things kind of evolve through our legislative leaders and reflect the will of the people, that was clearly taking place when it came to same-sex marriage and gay rights. I mean, that was happening state by state in this country through a legislative process. I think that's the way it should happen, and I think we'd be in a better place. But that process was not what happened with the Supreme Court. And when they declared this a new declaration for same-sex marriage, and unfortunately now it can't happen because we've had this court decree. Let me just read what the Justice Clarence Thomas stated in his dissent regarding this very issue. Although our Constitution provides some protection against such governmental restrictions on religious practice, the people have long elected to afford broader protections than this court's constitutional precedents mandate. Had the majority allowed the definition of marriage to be left to the political process, as the Constitution requires, the people could have considered the religious liberty implications of deviating from the traditional definition as part of their deliberative process. Instead, the majority's decision short-circuits that process with potentially ruinous consequences for religious liberty. I was a little bit disappointed, and I know this has probably been brought up, I would think, here in previous conversations, when the Solicitor General, Don Varelli, when asked by Justice Alito, what are the ramifications if we find in favor of same-sex marriage to religious freedom? For example, what about the tax-exempt status of churches and their charities and what they're providing to society? Will that be threatened? And what you would have hoped would have happened would be some reassurance. Oh, no. Religious freedom will be protected and preserved. But what did the Solicitor General say? I don't know. I don't know. It certainly is an issue. I don't know. It certainly is going to be an issue. Which for religious freedom folks are going to say, wait a minute. I'm a little concerned about what the ramifications are going to be then to my religious freedoms. And, of course, that's why we're here today to talk about it. The balancing process, the opportunity for give and take that comes with the legislative process to work out the warts, to find the, what are the intended or unintended consequences and work through that, has been short-circuited, as Justice Thomas has said, by this court decision and taken away the legislative process, which allows us to work so well together, which, again, we've seen here in Utah. Again, we predate the court decision. We've come up with an anti-discrimination. We've worked through the pros and the cons and came up with what we think is a good balance point here. Chief Justice Roberts said, respect for sincere religious convictions has led voters and legislators in every state that has adopted same-sex marriage democratically to include accommodations for religious practices. The majority's decision imposing same-sex marriage cannot, of course, create any such accommodations. Again, it's left out of the equation. It's not part of the discussion. And again, let me just hasten to say that we don't need to jump to conclusions. I don't know that we need to be overly alarmist. The sky is falling mentality probably does not help us get to where we need to be. We need to be thoughtful, rational folks, and respect rights on all sides and difference of opinions. But I do note that, again, in this particular issue, because I'm concerned about the state right aspect of this, historically, constitutionally, in my view, I agree with the four dissenting justices. And it was interesting that four of them dissented and thought it was so important the dissent, that they each one wrote their own opinion to emphasize their dissenting voice. It was a 5-4 vote. If Kennedy, you thought, would have stayed in his position when he wrote against the Defense of Marriage Act, you'd think it'd been 5-4 the other way. So again, unfortunately, we have a division here in the Supreme Court that's as close as it can be, which represents a division that we have in the country today. I think the Washington Post had a poll out here recently that very bluntly asked the question, and it comes down to deciding where we should be. Should we protect religious liberties, or is it more important to protect the LGBT community? The overwhelming majority, is like 56% to 36%, said religious liberties is number one for the people of America. That doesn't mean it's right or wrong. I'm just saying that we can see that we have a division in the country that we're going to have to work through here. Again, in talking about kind of this lack of understanding, and I certainly don't think we should proceed with a chip on our shoulder and say, oh, I'm going to take my marriage and go home now, take my ball and go home. You know, we do have people out there say we got to get out of the marriage business altogether, and that's going to be part of the discussion. But there is a reason why we have marriage, and protecting children that are a product of marriage, and certainly the contractual agreement between the spouses for protection, to honor and obey, and to help. You know, that marriage contract has been an important part of our history that I don't think we want to just do away with out of hand. Justice Thomas, in referring to this kind of what he thought was a weak gesture in this decision toward religious liberty, said this: religious liberty is about more than just the protection for religious organizations and persons, as they seek to teach the principles that are so fulfilling and so central to their lives and faith. Religious liberty is about freedom of action in matters of religion generally, and the scope of that liberty is directly correlated to the civil restraints placed upon religious practices. So the right of protection to one's beliefs should include the ability to actually live those beliefs, to actually practice those beliefs in your life. And anyway, as people of faith, I think it's important that we, in fact, extend love and consideration and respect for those who have a different point of view. Religions are not united in how they view this. As I noted earlier, the Episcopalian Church just held their general conference in Salt Lake City. I spoke to that group, and later that day, they in fact voted in their body, the governing body of the Episcopalian Church, to in fact allow their priests to in fact perform same-sex marriages. That's a different point of view religiously than other churches out there. So we're not united on what we think the religious persuasion should be on this very issue. And so we need to, again, I think, understand and protect religious liberties for all folks. And they're going to find that some don't see it the same way that others do. And I think that as we have religion as part of the public square, I mean, you look historically, if you look at Dr. Martin Luther King, his march to Selma, the power of what took place at that time was not just the fact that they were standing up for anti-discrimination and civil rights, but they had the religious community was a part of that effort. It empowered them even more so for the principle of anti-discrimination and protecting the rights of the minority. So the religious aspect of this certainly should be hand in hand with some of the principles and values that we espouse as this country, and ought not to be separated out. It really is a matter of working together to find the right laws and statutes in place to protect religious liberty as well as the rights of the gay community. So let me just conclude by saying this is, again, a remarkable thing that's taken place in Utah. I think a positive thing that's been a team effort. We've proven that we can establish laws that we, when we work together, and not diminish our mutual desire to work together in society and a community to live happy and free of discrimination. And what we've done here, it protects that opportunity here in the state of Utah and respects the rights of others along the way. So I thank all those who have been a part of that. And thank you for being a part of this discussion today. I'm honored to be a part of it, and we'll have question and answers for a few minutes. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much to Governor Herbert for that address and for also just taking his time to be with us and discuss these important issues. We do have about 15 minutes for questions, so yes, we have. If you would wait for the microphone and just state your name and so forth. Thanks.
Governor Herbert, thank you for your remarks.
It's on.
Okay, this
maybe,
way?
Maybe eat it.
Governor Herbert, thank you very much for being here and for your remarks. If we define compromise as a successful win-win negotiated settlement between differing parties, I can agree that there's room for congratulation. But if we define compromise as a capitulation of standards, like we talk about compromising our standards, some people may be concerned that this does make us vulnerable with regard to religious liberty. And it puts us at risk. Not everyone that is opposed to LGBT behavior does that simply because of religious rights. Sometimes they don't think it's a loving or honest thing to do to promote behavior that has medical, physical, emotional, even social consequences that cultures and civilizations have been concerned about for centuries. So is there a way of looking at the Utah Compromise as just another Missouri Compromise, and that we might have made ourselves more vulnerable rather than making ourselves stronger?
Well, good, is this on? Good comments, and certainly it does cause us to reflect. But, compromise, unfortunately, has become a dirty word in many circles because they, just like you've said, well, that's all you just capitulated. And maybe that is part of the definition of compromise. We've capitulated in some points of view in regard and respect to other people's points of view. You know, the great compromise was the founding of our country with our founding fathers. I mean, some of the attitudes we have today, I wonder if they could have come together on a great compromise. You know, to get us to the Constitution we have today. I would hope that in our compromise, the intent at least has been to respect people's rights and a different point of view. You know, we don't have a democracy here. We don't want a democracy. Our founding fathers were very wise in creating a republic. And my cousin Benjamin Franklin said it's a republic. You know, when he was asked, you know, what kind of government have you given us, Dr. Franklin? It's republic if you can keep it. And we have that threat now. Can we keep the republic? And again, it's designed to protect the rights of the minorities over the tyranny of the majority. And again, it doesn't matter as a governor, it doesn't matter what I personally believe as governor. I'm an active member of the Mormon faith. You know where I would come down on this issue. I certainly, when we did the vote in 2004 on Amendment 3, you know, I spoke very much in favor of that amendment. But now as governor, it's a matter of me enforcing the law. I think we made, the worry I've got is where we had governors and attorney generals that were saying they would pick and choose the laws they chose to enforce. And I made the comment that really is the slippery slope in the road to anarchy and chaos. I was pilloried by one of the local papers about that because they tried to equate with my saying that if we did not enforce the laws, if governors and attorney generals choose to pick and choose what laws that they'll enforce, could lead us to anarchy. They said, Governor Herbert says that same-sex marriage will lead to anarchy. I never said that. I don't believe that. But I do believe there's a process and principles in place here that need to be upheld. and we as a republic need to represent the will of the people. That was actually taking place legislatively. I feel it's unfortunate. I do kind of follow down in agreement with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Supreme Court Justice, who said, in talking about Roe versus Wade on abortion, that the problem we have in this country was determined by 9 people in black robes rather than through the legislative process, which has allowed this country to continue to be divided on the issue of abortion. I think in a similar way, not exactly the same, but in a similar way, the fact that the same-sex marriage has been determined by the Supreme Court rather than legislatively will lead to still continued division and some chaos and uncertainty and we'll have to work through over time. There's no reason for any LDS person here or other religious person to feel like that their views have been compromised. We just need to make sure that in the laws that we put together now because of the court decision that those religious liberties are protected. Not only have we strengthened the First Amendment, but we need to in fact define some of the other things in our state statutes to protect, which is what the intent we did with our laws here in Utah, to protect religious liberties at the same time.
Thank you. Okay, let's see, take the question there and then down here.
Thank you. Nationally, the press has been reporting that while they're looking at Utah and saying, okay, you've reached this great compromise, they've interviewed others that have said, well, this won't work in our state or this won't work elsewhere. What are your thoughts or your feelings about why they're saying that?
Well, I don't want to dominate the conversation. You've got these great intellects here. I was with the president not too long ago, and he visited Utah, and I'd met with him in the White House on a few occasions, and I've talked about a number of issues with the president. I'm kind of the Western governor, our public lands, endangered species, energy development are unique to the West. And unfortunately, in the East, those things are really not as well understood. And I've talked with him about what we're trying to do with an alternative to Medicaid and my approach, which was called Healthy Utah. And he at least acknowledged, he says, that may work in Utah, it wouldn't work in my state of Illinois. He said that based on just kind of the culture we have here, the pioneer spirit, the self-help, the pull yourself up by your bootstraps mentality. And so I expect that there probably are regional differences. Judge Brindise talked about us being laboratories of democracy. Again, I'll just use healthcare. The healthcare needs of Utah, where we have a very young population, our median age is 29.2 years of age, is very, very different than the healthcare needs in Arizona or Florida, where we have more senior citizens. I need prenatal care. They need end-of-life care, so the demands on our healthcare systems are not the same. And that's why the state aspect of this, the idea of federalism, the states as a co-equal partner with the federal government, is a very important, integral part of this debate. We're talking about a specific issue, but the concept that really scares me more than anything is this loss of autonomy given to the states to be laboratories of democracy, innovators and developers of new processes and new aspects that we think government should be involved with, even limiting the government. And I won't go into my treatise on this, but I could speak for another hour. But that's the big casualty here in my view, along with whatever the same-sex marriage does specifically and the concern we have of eroding religious freedom. But the concept of state rights, my gosh, we ought to have the whole country, Republican, Democrat, and Independent alike, arise in mass and say, this is not right. This shall not stand. That's the concern I've got.
Okay. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, this question is for Senator Adams. Governor Herbert just kind of in fun said that as you let out on House Bill 296, perhaps you drew the short stick, the short straw. I think we all suspect there was probably more to it than that. So my question is, this is a little more personal, why you? What was it that motivated you to take the leap?
Great question. I appreciate that. Over the history of what's been going on, as the governor alluded to, this is not a new issue. In the Senate, we had naturally so conflicting ideas. Senator Urquhart was running, if you remember, a bill called SB 100. At the same time, Senator Stuart Reed was promoting religious liberties. He didn't talk a lot about it, but he had several bills. Last legislative session, if you remember, we were given same-sex marriage without any legislative compromise. I believe that we didn't have any religious liberty protections, as Judge Shelby ruled, or as the Supreme Court just ruled. So this legislative process, this Utah compromise, gave us those religious liberties protections that we lacked when we had that Supreme Court ruling. In the light of that, we didn't hear one bill, not last legislative session, the legislative session before, because we were waiting for at least an appeal process to run through. At the same time, Stuart Reed indicated he wasn't going to run again. So in the Senate, there wasn't an individual that was really looking at religious liberties. We had the anti-discrimination with Senator Urquhart. Stuart Reed and I have the same first name. Sometimes they call us Stuart Squared. But we talked together. And he invited me to come talk to him. And through that process, and again, I believe I have deep-seated feelings about religious liberties and those type of things. We worked through a process that started almost a year ago. And so as things evolved, that became my involvement.
So, let's see.
Run up in the middle.
In the middle, in the back there. Yep.
What are the using the Utah Compromise as an example? What are the implications of states who are trying to implement it post Supreme Court decision versus Utah, who implemented it pre Supreme Court decision?
I maybe could speak to that. When we implemented this last legislative session, again, Judge Shelby ruled in December of 2013. So we had same-sex marriage in the state of Utah by judicial mandate. So everything we did last legislative session had to assume that the same-sex marriage would be the law of the land. So all of the, as you delineate down through, everything we did assumed that. So there is no difference. When the Supreme Court ruled, we have all of the protections in place. We have protections for employers. We have protections for free speech of the workplace. We have protections for landlords. We gave protections for housing and employment to the LGBT community. We have protection against government retaliation. So as we walk through that entire process, we have put in place many of the protections that maybe post a Supreme Court ruling other states might be looking at. And the governor's right on. States' rights is a great thing. Laboratories of innovation. There may be some things like the small employer definitions that are different in Utah, that can't go to other states. But the majority of what we did, if other states wanted to, could be used post Supreme Court ruling to help them maintain their religious liberties. They're so significant to be able to have people believe and express what they want in and out of the workplace without employer or government retaliation.
Let me just add to that. Again, the advantage we have is we were ahead of the curve and anticipated the problems we're going to have in the public square and the concerns of religious liberty. And I don't think that our law is perfect by any means, but I think we did anticipate. Now, for example, that the Supreme Court decision has taken place, we've seen the ramifications. The writing's kind of been on the wall a little bit. As we see Catholic charities now closing their doors in some states, not getting involved in foster care anymore. LDS church services getting out of adoption business. Some of the ramifications of this and the mandates that's going to be put upon them by the government in light of this. We see now in the state of Oregon where they're putting together a list of what you, if you're going to be a foster parent, what you can or cannot say to your foster child. And you cannot say, for example, that if there's a same-sex attraction, that that's wrong. or you cannot use religion as a reason to, in fact, encourage them to not participate in same-sex activity. Again, those are ramifications of the court case, which means that the dynamics will be a little bit different in states as they try to put together something that addresses what they now find on the books by court fiat, as opposed to we anticipating it in advance. I expect that there'll be discussions in future legislatures about what, on both sides, what do we do to fine-tune it? And I'm a little hesitant about that because that could just disrupt the apple cart. But clearly, as we go forward, the ramifications of this are gonna have impact, and probably each state with their different culture, different political persuasion, you know, we're not all the same, and they'll probably find a different way, to follow that path. Last but not least, the thing that I thought was the most beneficial to us, which I think other states can copy, this part they can copy, and that is you've got to put it in one bill. If you have one bill out there that's a pro one thing or the other side's going to try to defeat it. There's nothing in it for them on that particular bill. If you can combine them into one bill, anti-discrimination for the gay community as well as anti-discrimination for the religious rights of people, that forces people to have to work together and come up with a compromise that doesn't violate principles and values but brings people together in the proverbial Steve Covey, professor at BYU, win-win approach.
So one final question, Professor Sharps.
Governor Herbert, you discussed the exchange between Attorney General Varelli and Justice Alito over the implications of the same-sex marriage decision for religious freedom down the road. Have you developed a view yet about whether there needs to be either national or state-level legislative responses specifically addressing some of those issues, as well as the issues that were raised in the dissenting opinions that you cited in your speech as well?
Well, I certainly developed the opinion that I think that we need to. What I'm not certain of is what is that specifically to be. I am concerned. We've addressed this in Utah, but when you think about the fellow who donated $1,000 and gets fired because the folks didn't like it. And again, he was attacked by the opposition and forced out. We see the cake company up in Oregon. The public outcry about that was quite huge. They had on what's called GoFundMe, their legal bills were in the $120,000, $150,000 range, I can't remember what. But on GoFundMe, they'd raised $109,000 from donations. The opposition attacked the GoFundMe and got them to pull that down and said, you know, how despicable is this that they're, you're giving money? And so they stopped the fundraising. I mean, the tolerance needs to go both ways. And so how we shore that up, I'm not certain, but it certainly will be a discussion, I think, going forward. But it needs to be done with everybody at the table. I know we're out of time, and I'll just sum up by saying this, because I think this really is an important, at least from my perspective. Again, this is unique to me, at least as myself describe myself. I am very conservative in political thought. I am a right-of-center Republican. I'm probably the most conservative governor we've had in Utah, maybe in my lifetime, maybe since Brigham Young, I don't know. But it's I'm pretty conservative in principle. But I am moderate in tone. I don't think we do ourselves a lot of justice if we're too shrill. People turn you off and don't listen. And if you can't get people to listen, you can't convert them. So I'm conservative in principle, but I'm moderate in tone in how I go about things. That's just kind of my personality. But I am very inclusive in process. I will sit down with anybody and let's discuss the issue in respectful tones. And you can agree with me 180 degree difference of opinion, but I want to hear what it is and see if we can't find a way to work together and not violate principle, but come up with a compromise. And I think that's the way we ought to address this issue. Whatever your values are, conservative, liberal, hold to them. But we ought to be moderate in our tones, and we ought to be inclusive in our process. Last but not least, and again, any success I have, I owe to two women in my life, my mother and my wife. Obviously, my father, and I had two of them, by the way, were great influences in my life, too. But a principle that my wife taught me, which I'll just give you here as my last word of counsel, and I won't tell you the incident that took place that prompted this, but it was people that were offended and should not have been offended for some activity that had taken place. And my wife taught me, she says, you know what we need to do as a people? We ought to take the attitude that we'll be slow to offend others. We ought to be concerned about how other people's feelings, what they're going through. We haven't walked in their moccasins. We don't know all the turmoil that's going on in other people's lives. Sometimes people act irrationally. Maybe they've got some challenge in their life that we don't know about. But we ought to be very slow to offend people. We ought to be careful in how we address issues. But then she said, we ought to be just as slow to take offense. We ought to be slow to offend people, be careful, respectful, but we ought to be slow to be offended. We end up having righteous indignation on issues that you sometimes wonder, that's a minor thing. And if we would take that approach, I think we'd have better communication. I think we'd have better understanding, and that better understanding would lead to better policy and better outcomes as a society. Thank you.
Join me in thanking.
If I could, I might just add a little bit to what the governor has said. Again, what a significant thing is, as you look at, sometimes there are conflicts between the legislative and executive branch, and maybe they're designed and natural, but to have the governor of the state of Utah, he, again, as lieutenant governor, he traveled the state, but as governor, he's doing the same thing. He's at every event. Maybe he's attended every birthday party of every citizen of the state of Utah twice. I'm not sure, but he's at everything. But this is something that's so significant for him. What he said is right on. It's great to be here with him. I'd just like to say in response to the tax exemption, so you know too, and in 297, we prohibited government retaliation. So religious nonprofits, so significant, cannot lose their tax exemption because of 297 in the state of Utah against state or local tax exemption. So again, through his leadership, through what has been done, through this collaborative process of both of them, we have a great solution, and many of the issues have been already dealt with. So again, thank you, Governor. Appreciate you being here.
We'll start the next session at 20 after to give us 15 minutes to break. So thank you to everyone, and we'll start promptly at 20 after.
Yes, you helped us get through this. Thank you very much. Religions are getting out of the business of helping. And if we, I mean, that's not a good thing. If we, in the public square, we're forcing religion to take a back seat. So